Secrets of the Unified Field, that's the work by Joseph Farrell, our guest tonight. We're going to come back and talk about First Disclosure with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Joseph, tell us about the Vero edition and Morris Jessup.
Well, this is the book that actually began the Philadelphia Experiment story. Morris Jessup was a famous astronomer back in the early 50s, and he was also one of the very first scientists that became interested in the field of ufology. And he wrote a kind of a popular study, an examination, basically, of UFOs and other strange things that he called The Secret of the UFOs or The Mystery of the UFOs. I forget the exact title. But one day he gets a postcard in the mail that's written in this strange scrambled English, and it tells him about the Philadelphia experiment, and he kind of writes it off as a hoax, and then he gets yet another letter, and this, of course, is the very first of the letters that Carlos Miguel Allende actually sends to him. And again, he tries to find out a little bit more about it from Allende, who doesn't really communicate too well. But in the meantime, a copy of his book is sent to the Office of Naval Research. Again, the same committee that, you know, had that strange picture of von Braun and these men that received this copy of Joseph's book. Okay. And in the book, there are all these very strange annotations in the margins. And I reproduce a great segment of the Vero edition in my book because it's something that most people have heard about that know about the story, but they haven't really got access to it. So what this committee did, what these naval officers that got this book did, is they contacted the Vero Company in Garland, Texas, which is right outside of Dallas, and had them print up a very short, limited run of Jessup's book with the annotations. That's the Vero edition. It's named after the Vero Corporation that actually did this book. And they circulated it among the committee and gave Jessup a few copies of it for himself and asked him to kind of be involved in the project. And in the book, in these annotations, there are two very strange allegations that are made. Number one is, of course, the story of the Philadelphia experiment, that the Navy actually made a ship invisible and that it was keeping it more or less under great secrecy and under wraps. The other thing that's very, very strange, and it just leapt out at me when I read it, is that the annotators also refer to a very ancient cosmic war, and they tie the science of the Philadelphia experiment to the technology that was used in that war. So, you know, I've written a book, in fact, entitled The Cosmic War, and, you know,
I'm not going to let you go without talking with you about this.
Well, you know, it just really took me for a loop, George, when I read this, because I was really not expecting to see anything even remotely like that in the annotated edition. But, you know, putting yourself in the Navy's shoes for a moment, they get a copy of this book in which it's alleged that they performed some experiment during the war, and they actually achieved optical invisibility of an entire destroyer escort. You know, we're talking about a 5,000-ton ship here. And not only that, but they're also talking about UFOs and flying saucers and how it's all the same technology. And, oh, yes, this stuff was once used to fight a very ancient war. Now, this has got to pique the Navy's interest.
Now, was this ancient war here? Now, when you say cosmic war, was that still an Earth war with ancient civilizations, or did this happen out in the cosmos?
Oh, I think it was on Earth and in our local solar system neighborhood.
Okay, okay.
You know, this, again, it goes to some of the work of Mr. Hoagland, you know, in dating not only the Mars anomalies, but the moon, and more recently, the very strange moon of Saturn named Iapetus, because, you know, there's every indication that all of these things are indeed artificial. So, you know, what do the authors of the Vero edition know? And to even talk about cosmic wars and read ancient texts in that way, you have to be familiar with those texts. And,
sure.
You know, Carlos Allende just does not seem like the sort of person that would be. But interestingly enough, in this edition, they mention the fact that they're gypsies and that this is somehow a part of their lore, of their tradition. So, you know, you put all this together, the Navy's getting this book talking about disappearing ships, flying saucers, anti-gravity, and cosmic wars. So you know that it's bound to pique their interest just for those reasons alone.
Of course.
And, you know, standing right in the middle, sitting right in the middle of the table of this committee is none other than Dr. Werner von Braun. So, you know, it just dovetails in so many different directions. It's really quite astonishing.
And he told his aide, Carol Rosen, Dr.
Right.
Carol Rosen,
right.
of the existence of extraterrestrials. And also he mentioned what the Illuminati was going to do and create this fictitious war with them
right.
in order to control us.
Right. And, you know, that's yet another little aspect of this story that is so very peculiar. You know, when you dig into this, let's just look at the record here for a moment. We have, you know, with the appearance of Mr. Hoagland's book, Dark Mission, you have a cogently argued, well-documented case that there is some sort of not only covert space program, but you have a documented case that many aspects of that program are indeed controlled or influenced by what, for all intents and purposes, is an esoteric or occult agenda. But dovetailing into that, there's always this idea of some sort of hidden, off-the-books technology that's also in play. Now, I found that fascinating when I was reading the book because, to be honest with you, I had to read the book twice. You know? But, you know, I found more or less the same thing when I was researching all of this business about the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell. What do we have in Nazi Germany? Well, we have the attempt to create the beginnings of a space program. And what do we find when we look at it carefully? Well, we've got the rockets, of course. We've got the V-2, the V-1, and then the projected rockets, the intercontinental rockets, which I even think there's a strong possibility that some of those were actually tested prior to the end of the war. So you have a kind of a secret but public program that is very visible in the form of falling rockets on London. But with the Bell, you have an even more secret program that is trying to develop a kind of physics that would lead to field propulsion, to a wholly different kind of technology for space travel. So it's beginning to look to me like there's a strong possibility that this two-track space program actually has its roots during World War II. And, you know, once we said that, then we've really crawled way out on a limb. But I think that's where the evidence has to take us.
Under Jessup's work, he also talks about levitation.
Yes.
Let's explain what's going on in that area.
Well, Jessup was really a fascinating man once you read his book, and I try and reproduce as much of it as I can in my new book. He was an astrophysicist, so he's looking at all of these strange things, the Bermuda Triangle, the very mysterious plane crashes and ship disappearances that occur there. He's looking at the ancient monuments in Peru and Egypt and so on and so forth, and trying to explain how it is that a supposedly primitive peoples can actually engineer these monuments that just would defy any modern-day engineer to do. And he comes up with the idea that it had to have been accomplished by some form of levitation. And in seeking a scientific rationalization for all of these different phenomena that he's investigating in his book, he hits upon the idea that it's got something to do with Einstein's unified field theory. Now, George, to me, this is fascinating because when he wrote his book, of course, the academic community just all but hounded him out of you know, circles of respectability. But in point of fact, he's really so far ahead of his time, and yet at the same time, he's really saying basically the same thing that Gabriel Crone was saying, that this theory, even though it's incomplete, is an engineerable theory. And I think this, too, is what had to have caught the U.S. Navy's attention when his book arrived at the Pentagon.
All right, let's move on a little bit more. Of course, Charles Berlitz was one of those responsible for giving us the great information on the Philadelphia experiment, but also the Bermuda Triangle.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, the connection here, again, I think, lies in some version of these late 1920s unified field theories, and more particularly with the idea of torsion. And the reason why is, just to kind of explain it a bit, general relativity basically does not allow or even take into consideration, really, any kind of local variation of gravitational acceleration on the surface of a planet. So in other words, you don't have the theoretical possibility of a place of extreme gravitational or magnetic anomalies like the Bermuda Triangle is. But when Einstein comes out in 1928 with a unified field theory that has as one of its central components this idea of torsion, he once again introduces into theoretical possibility the idea that there can be such locally anomalous areas of magnetic and gravitational attraction. So, you know, Jessup hits upon this as an explanation for the Bermuda Triangle, and that's kind of what gets him, and for that matter, Berlitz, involved in the Philadelphia experiment, because this is what Berlitz uncovers when he starts researching it. So, again, we're going right back to these unified field theories and this higher dimensional physics.
It's amazing because many of the things that Jessup writes about, later on, other writers would pick up on his work, like Zechariah Sitchin and people like that.
Yeah, he's Jessup, you know, I'm so glad you mentioned that because Jessup, in a certain sense, is decades ahead of the alternative research community by mentioning these possibilities. He's really kind of the first one, George, that I think had the courage to stick his neck out there and say, well, we've got to explain all of this stuff too, and the conventional models are just inadequate to account for it.
Oh, no, I agree with it. And I remember reading some of Berlitz's accounts of some of these stories. Fascinating by it. One of the reasons why it pushed me in the direction I'm in now, Joseph.
Yeah, well, the same here with me, George. You know, Berlitz, I read his book on the Philadelphia experiment years and years ago, and then, of course, that got me interested in his Bermuda Triangle book. And it was the same thing for me, and especially, you know, the indications that run throughout his books that this all has something to do with these 1920s and early 1930s unified field theories, and that's kind of what set me off on it.
Did anybody ever find Carlos Allende?
Oh, yes. He one of the strange episodes I recount in the book is that he actually surfaced at the Varro Company in Dallas, Texas, and this was after Berlitz and Moore's book had come out. And the Berlitz book on the Bermuda Triangle, I should say. And he shows up at the Varro Company and basically demands hush money, you know, from them not to talk about it anymore. And then he comes out and publishes a series of articles in magazines in the 1970s in which he says that, well, my letters were all a hoax. And then turns around a little bit later and says, oh, no, they weren't. You know, jeez. So yes, he definitely surfaces, and if my memory serves me correctly, he just died very recently.
Well, God, I would have loved to have gotten to him.
Oh yes, me too.
My God, where did Tesla stand during any of this?
Well, this is another aspect of the story that I found very fascinating. The engineers that I referred to that performed this proof of concept experiment, they did this in the early 1990s. And they published a paper called Tesla's Egg of Columbus and the Philadelphia Experiment, and they presented this. It's a rather technical paper. They presented it to the International Tesla Conference in 1994. And in this paper, and I reproduce this in the book, they mentioned that in World War I, Tesla had presented to the then Undersecretary of the Navy, who just happened to be Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had presented an idea to the Navy of a means for deflecting torpedoes from U-boats by means of a rotating magnetic field. And these engineers speculate that this was probably the real basis, ultimately, that led to the formation of the Philadelphia Experiment. Because the man that was, of course, in charge of President Roosevelt's many scientific research projects during the war was a fellow by the name of Dr. Vannevar Bush. And he was very well acquainted not only with Tesla's work, but with this very proposal that he had presented to then Undersecretary of the Navy. So, you know, we have all of these connections that would indicate that at some point, and like Berlitz and Moore mentioned, Tesla was involved in the project up until about 1943 when he died. So, again, you know, you have these connections that are there, and it stands to reason that the Navy would have done this experiment. In fact, if you look at it in a certain way, George, they would have been derelict in duty not to have done it.
Why are there then so many rumors about the Eldridge, what happened? Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, the movie, The Philadelphia Experiment, mm-hmm. really kicked it into high gear.
Yes.
But where do we get these incredible stories of sailors half in and half out of a ship and things like that?
I think that part of it has to come from the physics itself. In other words, the potential for all of these things is certainly there, even though they're not part of Allende's original story. And, you know, this is one of the things that these engineers point out in their paper, is even though these other allegations aren't part of the original story, it is a remote theoretical possibility of the physics that's behind the experiment. So I think that's ultimately where you have to go. And I think, you know, a certain amount of it has to be, you know, people just jumping on the bandwagon and hoping to make a quick buck or whatever. But even then, I think we're still dealing with the potential that something like that may have happened.
Do you think someone like old Al Bielek really was on that ship?
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't even really go into his story at all in the book.
It's a great story.
Oh, yes, I know it is. I've heard him many times on your radio show. And, you know, I don't go into it simply because my approach in doing all of my books has always been to stick as close as I can, not only to the documentary evidence, but as close as I can to the scientific rationalization that evidence suggests. So I kind of leave the question open as far as that goes. I don't really even get into it in any detail. But again, as these engineers point out, the torsion tensor is capable of explaining or at least making possible some sort of displacement along the time axis of an object, namely a ship. So again, you know, you can't rule it out of court at all.
And then we've talked with Duncan Cameron, who claims that he was Al Bielek's brother mm-hmm. during the experimental phase, changed his name since he's been here in this time period. Again, part of the puzzle that just makes this story even stranger.
Well, you know, if you put the puzzle pieces together in a particular way, it does seem that something like this is possible. There was a fellow, a scientist, on many years ago, I think Art Bell had him on, by the name of David Anderson, who was actually a very serious credentialed physicist, that had come up with an idea for some sort of time machine in which he was going to manipulate very minute portions of time by using a system of rotating lasers. Well, you know, once we've said that, we're right back in the ballpark of the Philadelphia experiment and the Nazi Bell, because both experiments were rationalized on the basis of rotation, and that really is the key to this higher dimensional torsional physics.
Let's get involved now. Let's go out into the cosmos when we come back, Joseph Farrell. If you live on the East Coast, circle Washington, D.C., and get out there over the weekend of April 18th to the 20th. Just go to the coasttocoastam.com website and take a look at the X Conference 2008 information. I'll be there, so come on by. And exactly, Joseph, what was Albert Einstein's role in all of this?
Well, obviously, the first and premier role is that he's the formulator of perhaps the most famous version of the unified field theory, which would be the one that he formulated in his 1928 paper. But I think we have to go beyond that. You know, we do have these strange connections Einstein to the Navy, and that means, in my opinion, that he was brought in perhaps to serve as the technical consultant to doke out and tease out some of the mathematics that were suggested to the Navy in Nikola Tesla's project of a project to deflect torpedoes. So in other words, one of the things that emerges in the Philadelphia experiment, and I think this is precisely where Einstein was brought in, and some of his associates, incidentally, I think that one of the rationalizations that the Navy had for performing the experiment was to deflect projectiles. So in other words, we're dealing with kind of a 1940s version of Star Wars, if you stop and think about it. And again, that, you know, that plays into so many different areas of contemporary research and science. So I think that's probably where his role lied.
And then Wernher von Braun?
Well, this is really the interesting part, because in my previous book called The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, I point out that in the Magic 12 documents, in the White Hot Intelligence Estimate, the paperclip scientists are explicitly referred to as being brought in by the military to look at this crashed craft. Now, to me, that suggests a very different take on the Roswell crash than originally was suggested, and certainly the one that's popular in the ufology community. Because I don't think if the military had suspected that this was a genuinely extraterrestrial craft, that they would have shared this secret with their recently defeated enemies. And even Colonel Corso suggests that there was something about this craft that looked like familiar German technology, and that's the reason they were brought in. So von Braun, I think, if we put all the evidence together, we have on the one hand his probable reception of a copy of this Varro edition of Jessup's book, and on the other hand, we have him as one of the scientists brought in to look at this crashed craft in Roswell. So, in other words, this is a picture entirely consistent with what we see emerging inside of NASA. The Nazis have their hands in almost every sensitive pie that concerns space matters that exists inside of this country.
Albert Einstein would have been about 129 years old right now.
That's right. That's right.
Can you imagine that if you were still alive with this age of computers, what he'd be able to do?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it really kind of boggles the mind when you think of the fact that Einstein performed most of his experiments and most of his theories entirely in his head. So, yeah, you're right. You know, if he had computers, what would it be accomplished?
Oh, unbelievable.
Unbelievable, truly.
Okay, so give me your take, Joseph, on what you think happened in the 40s with the Philadelphia experiment.
Well, I think that, you know, your guests that you had on back in 2003 were correct. I think that the experiment, first of all, was performed at sea, and that this was the final stage of a series of experiments that had led up to this point. And they suggest they suggested in the interview, in fact, and then in the booklet, that the results were not anticipated when it was performed at sea. Now, interestingly enough, what they also pointed out was that when it was performed very close to Bermuda. So what happened, I think, was that for some unknown reason, when they did the experiment in its full-scale version at sea, they'd performed all the trials and tests up to this point, and they were successful. And I think what they were trying to do was really achieve some measure of radar stealth rather than total optical invisibility. But that for whatever reason, given local celestial conditions and other things that you have to factor into consideration with this kind of hyperdimensional physics, that these elements played a role in the unanticipated results, and that the experiment ran away and achieved some truly, truly breathtaking results that the Navy really didn't expect. And I think that your guest back on that show nailed it right on the head. And interestingly enough, what happened to the experiment, they also indicate a very peculiar thing, and I reproduce this documentation in my book. they suggested that the reason the Navy lost the experiment is that it was somehow shifted or sidelined into the U.S. Coast Guard. Now, you know, when I read that, I thought, well, of course, where is the last place on Earth that anyone is going to look for a black project like that? It certainly wouldn't be the U.S. Coast Guard. But they reproduced this document in their little booklet that shows that many of the logs concerning the Eldridge and the Terrazed that they were searching for had been checked out of the National Archives by someone that was attached to the United States Coast Guard. So it's, you know, the story is just very strange any way you examine it.
You know, Einstein was opposed to us having an atomic monopoly.
Right.
Instead, what he wanted was he wanted to equip the United Nations with nuclear weapons.
Right.
So they could maintain the deterrence.
Right. Well, Einstein's role in all of this is very peculiar, and I'm glad that you mentioned this, because one of the strangest allegations that Carlos Allende makes in his letters is that when Einstein proposed his unified field theory, he then retracted it because he was afraid of what humanity would do with it. And it's almost as if Allende is suggesting that somehow Einstein either knew about or later became familiar with some of the results of the Philadelphia experiment and then retracted his theory because he was appalled at what had happened during the experiment.
Let's talk for a moment about the cosmic war,
okay,
that story. But where do you get the book, Secrets of the Unified Field?
Well, it's available from either Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or Borders, or if they want to order the books directly from the publisher, that's Adventures Unlimited Press, and they do have a 24-hour credit card number. That's area code 815-253-6390, and there's a toll-free line that they can call during normal business hours. That's 1-800-718-4514. And I'd like to point out that if they place orders on three or more books, then there is a 10% discount directly from the publisher.
Okay, great. And Lex, you might want to put that 800-718-4514 number down on the website link that you have with Joseph Farrell, if you would. This is my way of communicating to my webmaster. High technology,
yeah.
Right? Nah, I've got computers and I'm hooked up. I mean, I'm like the bionic man over here in the cave, Joseph.
Well, I am too.
The cosmic war.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that. And how did you uncover this?
Well, actually, it was something that was kind of suggested to me, not only by Zechariah Sitchin's works, but there was an interview, I think, that Mr. Hoagland did back in 1998 with Art Bell and another gentleman, in which he briefly mentioned the possibility that we might even be looking at some sort of very ancient war on an interplanetary scale. And that got me to thinking because, of course, you know, you find adumbrations of that throughout many of the ancient Sumerian and Egyptian texts. So I decided to start looking at those texts a little bit more carefully to see if they had or could be viewed as containing some sort of physics that would be sophisticated enough to blow up that planet that is now the asteroid belt. And lo and behold, when you read the text in that way, it certainly does indicate that there was something like that in existence millennia ago. So, you know, it's truly a fascinating subject. And then, of course, Dr. Tom Van Flandern had published his book about the exploded planet hypothesis. And he pinpointed two dates, George, and these really kind of leapt out at me. He pinpointed dates of either 65 million years ago or about 3.2 million years ago. And it's that latter date, if you compare it to the Hindu epics, to the Sumerian epics, dovetail almost exactly and perfectly with these ancient texts. And that really got me started writing that book.
Well, you know, it is amazing how the Vedas, for example,
oh, yes,
talk about and describe a nuclear holocaust,
yes,
between Earthlings, of course.
Yes.
And, you know, Michael Cremo is a believer that civilizations did this a long time ago as well.
Oh, yes, I am too. And, you know, the interesting thing that Sitchin writes about in a book that he wrote called Wars of Gods and Men, you know, I'm not a subscriber to many of the details of Mr. Sitchin's work, but he makes a very interesting suggestion in that book that there was a super weapon that had to be destroyed that was capable of wreaking regional destruction on Earth and elsewhere. And that in this war, nuclear weapons were used by the side that did not possess that weapon. And I found that just, you know, an incredibly astonishing assertion to make. And what really kind of threw me for a loop was that Sitchin never really even pursued his own insight. And, you know, that was another little kind of motivation for me to write The Cosmic War, because I thought, well, gee whiz, if we're lobbing nuclear bombs around the Earth and Mars and anywhere else just to destroy an even more sophisticated technology, then what was that technology? And, you know, the ancient texts are just full of some very, very interesting suggestions.
The Giza Death Star Destroyed, the book that you wrote, is that tied into some of this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the questions I get a lot is, why do I write books about Nazi secret weapons, the Philadelphia Experiment, Cosmic War, and Great Pyramid as a weapon? Well, all of my books have as a basic theme this higher dimensional physics. And once we accept that physics, then what are the implications for the history we've been taught? So they all have to deal with that kind of peculiar interface. So, again, those books kind of play into this overall theme that we've been talking about tonight.
And you believe the pyramids were used as weapons?
Well, not all the pyramids. I think at the minimum. You know, I don't hold that hypothesis dogmatically, but I do entertain it because this is what the texts themselves and some of the aspects of the structure of the Great Pyramid in particular seem to suggest. At the minimum, I think Chris Dunn is absolutely correct. I think it was a machine of some
a power plant.
Yes, I think that you have to look at his conclusions based on the engineering of the structure and come to the same conclusion. It was some sort of machine. Where I think perhaps to a certain extent that he may fall short is that I think we have to explain its machine-like properties not in any conventional way. We have to explain it as a kind of a hyperdimensional machine that is designed to tap into, again, the energies that are present in the fabric of space and time for whatever purpose. But once we have a technology that's able to do that, then we can certainly weaponize it.
Now tell me, though, how was it used?
I think if we look at the structure and the Giza compound as a whole, which I show in the book, is laid out in a very, and Mr. Hoagland's going to love this, is laid out in a very tetrahedral geometry.
You guys use the same jargon, by the way.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the pictures I reproduce in that book is a rotation of the compound along an axis that runs right down through the Great Pyramid, and I rotate it through 120 and then 240 degrees, and what you end up with is a schematic of the Star of David, which of course is a two-dimensional analog of two embedded tetrahedra. So, you know, the whole compound embodies the geometry of this hyperdimensional physics, and on this score, Mr. Hoagland is absolutely 100% correct. So, you know, I got to thinking, well, if this was indeed a weapon, as some of these texts seem to suggest, then what happened? How did they use it?
And who did they use it on?
And who did they, yeah, more importantly, who did they use it on?
I mean, it's aimed up. Maybe they're shooting it into space.
Right. Well, I do think that probably it was used off-world, and I think some sort of weapon of that nature had to have been used to blow up that planet. After all, if we attribute that planet's explosion not to natural causes but to a war and to a weapon, then we have to have a physics sufficient to be able to do that. And standard nuclear bombs just are not going to do it. Neither are lasers or anything of that sort. So we'd have to have a hyperdimensional physics that is able to tap into these energies of space and time. And that, I think, basically is how that thing was used.
That is incredible. And what about the technology to make it? Where did it come from?
Well, this is another aspect that I get into in the cosmic war, but basically I think the technology is terrestrial. In other words, that it was made by humans. But one of the interesting things that the texts point out is that the human genus may not be confined to this planet. So, you know, in saying that, you know, we've opened up the extraterrestrial possibility. But the other thing that is very interesting in those texts, George, is that they make it very clear that at the end of this horribly destructive cosmic war, some of this technology was deliberately removed from this superweapon and either destroyed or used elsewhere, or in a very few cases where the technology could not be destroyed, it was hidden. And the texts themselves point to, hold on now, basically three locations where it might be found: Egypt, Iraq, and Mars.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What about it being in the Hall of Records at the base of the Sphinx?
Well, it could be there too. You know, again, the whole...
That's Egypt.
Right? Yeah, that's Egypt. And the whole Giza compound, as you know, is just honeycombed with underground chambers and tunnels that really haven't been explored. Or if they have, the Egyptian government isn't talking about it.
They'll never do that.
Yeah, they'll never do that. And I find it very interesting, you know, that Zahi Hawass has taken the step to wall off the compound. And, you know, the cover story is that they're trying to protect it from vandalism and terrorists. Well, you know, those pyramids have withstood the test of millennia and earthquakes and wars and everything else, and they're still there. And I don't think a terrorist with a suicide bomb or a fertilizer bomb is going to do much damage to those things. So I think there's some other agenda in play there, and I certainly think that the same is probably true in Iraq. I think that there is some sort of agenda in play to recover some of this lost technology that may be there.
William Henry believes there's a Stargate out there.
Well, again, you know, it's very interesting that you mention William's work, because this plays into this type of physics very directly and very definitely, this whole idea of torsion and time displacements and so on. So, again, I think, you know, we're looking at different pieces, basically, of the same puzzle.
Well, next hour we'll bring Richard C. Hoagland in, and then we'll take some phone calls for
sure.
As well, Joseph. It is fascinating work.
It is endlessly fascinating, and you know, you investigate it, and it just goes so many places.
I didn't have time to ask you, and let's see if you can squeeze this in 30 seconds. You write about the death of George Patton, General
Yes.
George Patton. How come?
Well, you know, many people find it suspicious, but I think that General Patton probably was murdered because his advance units that went into these secret installations in Nazi Germany would have given him field intelligence reports on what they were finding. So the one man in the American command structure who had more or less a complete picture, as complete a picture as the Nazis had, would have been General Patton.
And he may have been too much of a rogue, huh?
Exactly.
All right. We'll be up next on Coast to Coast AM.